A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking whether an average, only slightly crazy person could actually build an entire house by themselves. No builders, no electricians, no plumbers, just raw materials and determination. He wants to know if it's physically possible, how the costs compare to hiring professionals, and how common self-building has been throughout history. And honestly, this hits right at the tension between the romantic cabin in the woods fantasy and what actually happens when you're standing in front of a pile of lumber with a nail gun you barely know how to load.
That tension is exactly where this gets interesting, because the romantic version has had a massive resurgence. You've got the tiny house movement, the off-grid homesteading channels, the TikTok builders making it look like you can frame a wall in an afternoon. Housing affordability is a genuine crisis. Median home prices are pushing past $400,000 in the US, so the idea of building your own place for a fraction of that is incredibly seductive. But the gap between the YouTube edit and the actual experience is about the width of the Grand Canyon.
Of course it is. So let's define what we're actually talking about when we say build a house. Because it's not what most people imagine. We're not talking about a shed. We're not talking about a rustic cabin with no utilities. We're talking about a full, habitable dwelling. Foundation, framed walls, roof, plumbing, electrical, HVAC, interior finishes. Something you could actually live in without your insurance company laughing you off the phone.
And our hypothetical builder, let's call him the average, slightly crazy person, has a full-time job, maybe built a deck once, or assembled an IKEA bookshelf without leftover parts. He owns basic tools. He's got a budget somewhere between $50,000 and $150,000. He's watched a lot of YouTube, he's confident. Almost certainly overconfident. And we're going to set the legal questions aside for a moment, though we'll circle back because permitting and code inspection are not small hurdles, and focus first on the physical and technical feasibility. Can one human body and one human brain actually pull this off?
I want to know the honest answer, because I've seen the videos too, and they make it look like a montage of triumph.
With that scope in mind, let's look at the actual skill stack required. This is where the fantasy meets the spreadsheet. Because here's the thing most people don't realize, building a modern house involves at least 12 distinct trades. You've got excavation and site prep, concrete forming and pouring for the foundation, framing, roofing, siding, window and door installation, rough-in electrical, rough-in plumbing, insulation, drywall, trim and finish, carpentry, finish electrical, finish plumbing, flooring, painting, cabinetry. I'm probably forgetting a few.
That's already overwhelming, and you weren't even done.
Here's the kicker. Each of those trades has its own body of knowledge, its own specialized tools, its own common failure modes. A good framer knows things about load paths and shear walls that a good plumber doesn't need to know, and vice versa. The DIY builder has to be competent in all of them, not expert, competent, which means understanding enough to pass inspection.
What does competent actually look like in terms of learning, before you even pick up a hammer?
This is where the numbers get sobering. To reach what I'd call competent amateur level in any single trade, framing, say, or electrical, you're looking at roughly 200 to 400 hours of study. That's reading books, watching tutorials, reading the relevant sections of the building code, practicing on scrap materials. Multiply that by the 12 plus trades involved, and you're at somewhere between 2,400 and 4,800 hours of learning before you've even broken ground.
That's a year of full-time study, before the project starts.
A year of full-time study or 2 to 3 years of nights and weekends just to build the knowledge base. And that's not an exaggeration. The International Residential Code alone is over 900 pages. It covers everything from foundation depth requirements based on frost lines to the exact height of stair risers to how far apart electrical boxes need to be spaced. You can't just skim it. You have to understand the why behind each requirement, because an inspector is going to ask, and I saw it on YouTube, is not an answer that passes inspection.
The code exists for a reason. That's one of the big misconceptions, that building codes are just bureaucracy and red tape. Most of those requirements exist because someone died or a building collapsed. The seismic codes we have now trace directly back to the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. The electrical code provisions about grounding exist because people were getting electrocuted. Every paragraph in that 900-page book is a ghost story.
And that's the first major misconception we need to address. This idea that codes are arbitrary hoops to jump through. They're a record of failure. So when our hypothetical builder is studying the IRC, he's not just memorizing rules, he's learning the accumulated lessons of a century of catastrophic mistakes.
Can we pause on that for a second? Because I think people hear ghost story, and they nod along, but they don't really internalize what that means. Take stair riser height. The code says residential stair risers can't exceed 7 3/4 inches, and the variance between the tallest and shortest riser in a flight can't be more than 3/8 inch. That sounds absurdly specific until you learn that inconsistent riser height is one of the leading causes of falls on stairs. Your body expects each step to be the same height. You trip when it isn't. Thousands of emergency room visits a year trace back to that one seemingly arbitrary number.
The frost line requirement is another perfect example. In Minnesota, you have to dig footings down to at least 60 inches because that's how deep the ground freezes. If you pour a foundation above the frost line, the soil underneath freezes and expands. We're talking about forces that can lift an entire building, and then it thaws and contracts. Do that cycle a few dozen times and your foundation cracks apart. Somewhere, at some point, someone built a house on a too shallow footing and watched it tear itself in half over a single winter. That's the ghost story.
When you're reading that 900-page codebook, you're not just memorizing rules. You're reading a century of postmortems.
Let's talk about tools. Because even if you've done all that studying, you still need equipment.
This is the part where the YouTube videos really mislead people, because the person in the video already has a $12,000 table saw sitting just off camera.
This is a cost that catches people off guard. A professional builder already owns their tools and amortizes them across dozens of jobs. A DIYer has to buy or rent everything up front. We're talking about a concrete mixer or the forms for pouring a foundation, nail guns, air compressors, a table saw, a miter saw, circular saws, scaffolding or at least sturdy ladders, laser levels for grading and layout, a trencher rental for running utility lines. The total tool cost for a full house build lands somewhere between $15,000 and $25,000.
That's assuming you don't break anything or realize halfway through that you bought the wrong nail gun for the job.
Which you will. And here's a concrete example of how this plays out in practice. Let's say you're doing the roofing. You've watched the videos, you've got your bundles of shingles, you've got a roofing nailer you bought for $300. But what the video didn't tell you is that your compressor needs to maintain a specific PSI range for that nailer to drive nails to the correct depth. Too shallow and the shingles will blow off in the first windstorm. Too deep and you've punctured the shingle, creating a leak path. You spend half a day adjusting the compressor, ruining a dozen shingles, and eventually you realize you need a different regulator entirely. That's another $100 and another trip to the hardware store. Multiply that experience by every single trade.
Then there's the physical reality of construction work. This isn't a spreadsheet exercise. Concrete work means hauling 80-pound bags, and for a typical 1,500-square-foot slab, you're looking at over 400 bags. That's 16 tons of concrete you're moving by hand if you don't have a pump truck. Roofing means carrying bundles of shingles up a ladder, and each bundle weighs about 70 pounds. Drywall means hoisting 12-foot sheets over your head and holding them in place while you screw them in. The Consumer Product Safety Commission recorded 35,000 emergency room visits from DI, why construction accidents, in a single recent year. That's not counting the chronic injuries. The back problems, the knee problems, the tendonitis that shows up 6 months later. You're studying for 2 years, spending $20,000 on tools, and destroying your body in the process. And we haven't even talked about time yet.
The time commitment is where the whole thing really unravels for most people. A professional crew of 4 to 6 people can frame a 1,500-square-foot house in 2 to 3 weeks. a solo DI working nights and weekends, which means maybe 15 to 20 hours a week if they're really dedicated, is looking at 6 to 12 months just for framing. And framing is the fast part. Once you get into the interior work, the electrical rough-in, the plumbing, the drywall, the trim, the painting, everything slows down because the tasks are more detailed and the tolerance for error shrinks.
How does that actually play out on a day-to-day level? What does slows down mean in practice?
Let me give you a real scenario. It's a Saturday morning. You've got 8 hours to work on the house. You need to run the electrical rough-in for the kitchen. But before you can do that, you realize you need to drill holes through 16 studs to run the wire. You don't own a right-angle drill, so you're trying to do it with a standard drill, and it's taking forever. You finally get the holes drilled by noon. Then you start pulling wire and realize you're short by about 30 feet of 12-gauge Romex. It's now 1 p.m. You drive to the hardware store, 40 minutes round trip. You get back, you're pulling wire, and you realize you don't know whether the code requires a dedicated circuit for the microwave. You spend 45 minutes looking it up in the code book. By the time you've got that sorted out, it's 4 p.m. and you've run maybe a third of the circuits you planned. That was an entire Saturday. A professional electrician would have done the whole kitchen rough-in by lunchtime.
That scenario is painfully vivid. And you'd have that exact experience every weekend for 2 years.
So what's the total timeline? Based on case studies, and Fine Home Building Magazine did a thorough analysis of this, a DIYer building a 1,200 square foot house logged about 3,200 hours of actual construction labor. That's on top of the study time. Over 2 to 4 years of nights and weekends, assuming you never take a break and never hit a problem that stops you cold for a month while you figure out how to fix it. And you will hit those problems.
Compare that to the professional crew.
That same 1,200 square foot house took a professional crew about 1,100 hours. So the DIYer spent roughly 3 times as long, and that's assuming they didn't have to redo anything major. The professional crew is faster not just because they're more skilled, but because they're coordinated. They know who's doing what. They're not spending half their time walking back to the truck for a tool they forgot or watching a YouTube video on how to flash a window properly.
There's a case study I want to mention, the Unskilled House Project by Chris Magwood. He's an experienced natural builder, not a novice, and he had a team of 3 people. It still took them 18 months to build a single house. And these were people who knew what they were doing. The idea that a solo amateur could do it faster, or even in the same time frame, is just not realistic.
That brings up another point about the skill stack. There's a concept from the business world called T-shaped expertise, deep knowledge in one area and broad familiarity across many others. A professional electrician has deep expertise in electrical work and maybe broad familiarity with other trades. The DI, why house builder needs the opposite, they need genuine competence across every trade, but they don't need to be a master of any single one. That's actually harder in some ways, because you never develop the intuitive feel that comes from doing one thing thousands of times.
That's an interesting inversion. So you're saying the generalist has it harder than the specialist?
In this context, absolutely. A specialist develops what psychologists call tacit knowledge, the stuff you can't easily put into words. An experienced drywaller doesn't think about the angle of the trowel or the consistency of the mud. They just feel it. They know when it's right. The DIYer has to consciously think through every single motion, every single time, because they've never done it enough for it to become automatic. That cognitive load is exhausting in a way that's hard to appreciate until you've experienced it. It's why people come home from a day of learning intensive work feeling mentally drained even if they weren't lifting anything heavy.
We've established that it's technically possible, but brutally time-consuming. Now let's talk about the money, and the history that explains why we stopped doing this.
Let's start with the cost comparison, because this is where the DIY pitch really falls apart under scrutiny. A professionally built single-family home in the U.S. right now averages between $200 and $300 per square foot. Labor typically accounts for 40 to 50% of that total. So the DIY logic goes, if I eliminate labor costs, I can build for half the price. That's the 50% savings claim you see everywhere. The reality is that a realistic DIY build comes in at about $120 to $180 per square foot. That's a savings of 30 to 40%, not 50 plus. And that gap between the promise and the reality comes from 3 things. Tools you had to buy or rent, waste from mistakes and inexperience, and the rework that every amateur build requires.
Let's talk about those mistakes, because they're not small.
They're catastrophically expensive. A single plumbing mistake, let's say you vent a drain line incorrectly, might not show up for months. You'll finish the walls, paint the bathroom, and then one day you'll notice a smell, or worse, water staining the ceiling below. Now you're opening up finished walls, you're cutting out drywall, you might need to redo tile work. That one mistake can cost anywhere from $3,000 to $8,000 to fix. A foundation pour that fails inspection, maybe the concrete wasn't mixed right or the form shifted, means jackhammering out the slab and repouring. That's $8,000 to $15,000 right there.
Insurance doesn't love this either.
Many insurance carriers won't touch an owner-builder project at all, or they'll charge 2 to 3 times the standard premium. They know the statistics. They know that amateur electrical work causes fires and amateur plumbing causes water damage. And if you can't get insurance, you probably can't get a construction loan, which means you're funding this entire project out of pocket while also paying rent somewhere else.
Which brings us to the sweat equity trap. This is the part that really stings. If you value your time at even $20 an hour, which is below minimum wage in some states now, those 3,200 hours of labor represent $64,000 in lost income, or lost leisure, or lost time with your family. When you factor that in, the net savings from DIY construction essentially vanish. You've traded years of your life for a house that cost about the same as hiring a builder, except you did all the work yourself.
That's assuming you don't make any major mistakes, which you will. So, from a pure financial perspective, DIY home building is almost never the right move unless you genuinely enjoy the process and consider the learning experience part of the compensation.
Which some people do, and that's valid. But let's be honest about what it is.
Now let's look at the historical picture, because this is fascinating. The prompt asked how common self-building has been throughout history, and the answer is, extremely common until it wasn't.
Before 1900, roughly 60 to 70% of rural Americans built their own homes. Log cabins, sod houses on the prairie, balloon frame houses in the growing towns. If you wanted shelter, you built it. That was just how it worked.
The Homestead Act of 1862 is the definitive example. Over 1.6 million homes were built by settlers on 270 million acres of land, and almost all of them were self-built. These weren't contractors. These were farmers and former shopkeepers and immigrants who'd never swung a hammer before they arrived on their claim. They figured it out because they had to.
Let's be clear about what those houses were. They were small, typically 400 to 800 square feet. They had no plumbing, no electricity, no insulation beyond maybe newspapers stuffed in the walls. The lifespan of those structures was maybe 20 to 40 years before they needed major repairs or outright replacement. They were shelter, not houses in the modern sense. Comparing a sod house on the Nebraska prairie to a modern code-compliant home is like comparing a bicycle to a Tesla.
Even within that simpler paradigm, the failure rate was astonishing. Historical accounts from the homesteading period are full of houses that collapsed in the first winter, roofs that caved under snow load because the rafters were undersized, chimneys that caught fire because someone didn't understand clearance requirements. The difference is that when a sod house collapsed, you built another one. You weren't $50,000 in debt on a construction loan. The stakes were existential, but the financial ruin wasn't the same.
That's a really important distinction. The cost of failure was measured in labor, not in lost capital.
That's the second big misconception. People used to build their own houses all the time, so it must be easy. It wasn't easy then, and those houses were vastly simpler than what we build today. The shift to professional builders happened between 1920 and 1950, and it happened for good reasons. Building codes emerged, mortgages required inspections and professional certifications. Electrical and plumbing systems became standard, and those require specialized knowledge that most people don't have. By 2026, owner-built homes account for less than 2% of new construction in the United States.
Which is a tiny fraction.
In developing nations, self-built housing is still extremely common, over 60% of new housing in parts of sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. But those structures rarely meet what we'd consider modern building codes. They often lack proper electrical grounding, seismic reinforcement, insulation. They're shelter, and shelter is valuable, but they're not the kind of house we're talking about in this prompt.
The historical arc is clear. Self-building went from the default to the exception, and it happened because houses got more complex and the consequences of mistakes got more severe.
There's another dynamic worth mentioning. The modern DIY movement. The YouTube builders, the TikTok tiny house creators, they've created a distorted picture of what this process actually looks like. Most of those videos show the first 3 months clearing the land, pouring the foundation, framing the walls. That's the visually satisfying part. That's where you go from nothing to something that looks like a house. But then the videos stop. You almost never see the rough in electrical, the plumbing, the insulation, the drywall, the months of finish work. Those parts aren't cinematic.
Because watching someone mud drywall is the visual equivalent of beige wallpaper.
And that's the third misconception. You can learn everything from YouTube. YouTube tutorials show best case scenarios. They show a skilled person doing the thing correctly in ideal conditions. They don't show the three failed attempts, the code violations caught by the inspector, the frantic call to a structural engineer when you realize you didn't calculate the header size correctly for that window opening. They don't show the part where you're standing in the rain at 10 p.m. trying to get a tarp over the exposed roof because you didn't finish the underlayment in time.
There's actually a phenomenon in the DIY community that people call YouTube confidence, where watching someone else do a task perfectly gives you a completely inflated sense of your own ability to do it. It's related to the Dunning-Kruger effect. You've seen it done, so you feel like you've almost done it. But watching someone mud drywall is not the same as holding the trowel. Your brain doesn't know the difference between observing a skill and acquiring it, and that gap is where the real pain lives.
That's a perfect description, and it's amplified by the editing. A 20-minute YouTube video might represent 3 days of actual work, with all the mistakes, the trips to the hardware store, the do-overs, the staring at the wall trying to figure out what went wrong, all of that is cut out. What you're watching is the highlight reel. You're not watching the blooper reel, which is 90% of the actual experience.
Given all that, the skills, the time, the costs, the history, what should you actually do if you're serious about building your own home? Because I don't want to just tell people it's impossible. That's not true. It is possible. People do it. It's just much, much harder than it looks.
This is where we can offer some actual practical guidance. If you're determined to DIY, there are ways to do it that dramatically reduce your risk. The first and most important piece of advice, start small. Build a tiny house first, something under 400 square feet. Or better yet, build a workshop or a shed on your property. Learn the trades on a low-stakes project where a mistake costs you hundreds of dollars instead of tens of thousands. If you can build a weather-tight, code-compliant 200-square-foot structure, you've learned maybe 40% of what you need to know for a full house, and you've done it without risking your life savings.
That's actually sensible. And I'd add, if you can't even finish the shed, that's your answer right there. You just saved yourself 3 years and $50,000.
The shed is the cheapest honesty test you'll ever take. The second approach, and this is what I'd recommend for most people who want the sweat equity without the full nightmare, is to act as your own general contractor. In 38 U.S. states, owner-builders can legally pull permits and manage their own construction projects. You hire out the critical, dangerous, or highly regulated trades. Foundation work, electrical, plumbing, HVAC, and you do the rest yourself. Framing, insulation, drywall, painting, flooring, trim. That captures 60 to 70% of the labor savings while taking on maybe 20% of the risk. You're not going to burn your house down because you wired a panel wrong, because you didn't wire the panel at all.
You still get the satisfaction of building something with your own hands. You just don't have to learn the National Electrical Code from cover to cover.
Which is over 1,000 pages, by the way. The third piece of advice, before you do anything, study the International Residential Code. Not skim it. Understand why the requirements exist. And then go spend some time on an actual construction site. Habitat for Humanity is perfect for this. 20 hours on a habitat build will teach you more about the reality of construction than 100 hours of YouTube. You'll learn what it actually feels like to carry lumber all day. You'll see how professionals sequence their work. You'll discover whether you actually enjoy this before you've committed 3 years of your life to it.
You might discover that you hate it, which is also valuable information.
Better to learn that in 2 weekends than 2 years in.
Let me try to synthesize all of this. Building your own house is technically possible. People do it. But it requires roughly 2,400 to 4,800 hours of study before you start, $15,000 to $25,000 in tools, roughly 3,200 hours of actual construction labor spread over 2 to 4 years, and you'll save maybe 30 to 40% on the total cost. Savings that disappear if you value your time at anything above minimum wage. You'll be doing the work of 12 different trades, each of which takes years to master. You'll be working nights and weekends while holding down a job. You'll make mistakes that cost thousands of dollars to fix, and at the end of it, you'll have a house that might or might not be insurable.
Yet people do it, and some of them are happy they did. There's something deeply human about building your own shelter. It's one of the oldest human activities. The satisfaction of walking through a door you hung yourself, and a wall you framed yourself, on a foundation you poured yourself. That's real. It's just that the cost of that satisfaction is measured in years of your life and a significant probability of catastrophic failure.
Like adopting a feral cat.
I'm not sure that analogy holds, but I appreciate the effort.
You know what? Let me defend the feral cat analogy for a second. You see a scruffy cat on the street. You think, I can give that cat a home. It'll be grateful. It'll sit on my lap. So you take it in. And for the first 3 months, it hides under the couch and hisses at you. You spend hundreds of dollars at the vet. It destroys a set of curtains. And then one day, 2 years later, it finally climbs onto your lap and purrs. And you think, that was worth it. But was it? That's the question. That's DIY home building. The purr is real, but so was the 2 years of hissing.
I withdraw my objection. That's actually a remarkably apt analogy. The purr is real, but you're going to bleed for it.
Let me ask you something that points toward the future. We're seeing 3D printed houses start to become viable. There was a sub-$100,000 3D printed home completed in Austin, Texas recently. The first of its kind. Prefabricated panel systems are getting cheaper and more sophisticated. Does that make the DIY house more feasible, or does it just make the traditional builder more efficient?
I think it actually changes the whole equation. The real revolution might not be in DIY building at all, it might be in DIY design. We're seeing AI tools like Autodesk Forma that can generate code-compliant building plans based on your constraints and preferences. You design the house, the software checks it against local codes, and then you hand those plans to a professional builder who executes them. You get the creative control and the customization without the 3-year construction nightmare.
The future of self-building might be self-designing.
That's my bet. The physical construction is always going to be hard. It's heavy, dangerous, precise work that rewards experience. But the design process, the part where you decide what your home looks like and how it functions, that's becoming more accessible. And honestly, that's the part most people actually care about. They don't want to mud drywall. They want to live in a space that feels like theirs.
I think there's a deeper point here about where the real satisfaction comes from. When people talk about the dream of building their own house, they're rarely fantasizing about the actual construction. They're fantasizing about the autonomy, the idea that they made the decisions, that no one else told them where the walls would go or what the kitchen would look like. And you can get that autonomy without doing the physical labor. You can be the architect of your own life without being the drywaller of your own life.
That's beautifully put, and it's a much healthier way to think about it. Building a house is the ultimate 10,000-hour project. You can do it, but you should know what you're signing up for. And if you're still determined after hearing all of this, start with that Habitat for Humanity build. Start with a tiny workshop in your backyard. Learn whether you actually enjoy the work before you mortgage your future on it.
If you've ever tried building something bigger than a birdhouse, whether it worked out or ended in glorious disaster, we want to hear from you. The disasters might be more entertaining, honestly.
They usually are.
Send us your stories. We'll read the best ones on a future episode. And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
Tardigrades possess a specialized fluorescent protein that absorbs ultraviolet radiation and re-emits it as harmless blue light, effectively turning the creature into a microscopic UV shield, a discovery made when researchers noticed the animals glowing under ultraviolet microscopy.
Tardigrades are basically tiny glow sticks with survival instincts.
Nature is just showing off at this point.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact and the production. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps other people find the show. We'll be back soon with more questions you didn't know you needed answered.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.